Alan Quinn Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3, for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 11, delivered on February 27, 2017. The title of this lecture is Bonds.
Today, bonds. James Bonds. No, I had mentioned it before that finding quotes for bonds has become one of those very frustrating exercises. Used to be I could pull up bond quotes for you to see just really easily. And now it's like they aren't out there. The even the SEC has gotten involved saying there is a lack of information being provided about bonds. And as I've told you before, bonds are the unsexy instruments. Stocks, everyone talks about stocks. Stock went up, stock went down. Stock market did this today, stock market did that today. Even though the bond market is 10 times the size of the stock market, it is a quieter market, less risk, which means less volatility, essentially. But that does not mean that the bond market is not something that you should pay attention to. In fact, you can actually speculate the bond market and maybe make some money. You probably wouldn't want to do that as a routine, but there is no question about it that bonds are part of most people's portfolio. So, for example, is it hot in here? I'm already getting so hot. If I had an apple in my mouth, I think I was at a luau right now. When you invest, you obviously, well, I hope it's becoming obvious, and we'll talk a lot more about this in the second half of the course. A well-diversified portfolio is essential to minimizing that diversifiable risk. You should not expect a reward for bearing diversifiable risk because you can get rid of it and no market is going to reward you or even think about rewarding you for having that risk. So that means that you should build a portfolio of stocks and other instruments. How many? Well, rule of thumb is you can shake out maybe about, if you do it right, you can shake out about 95% of the diversifiable risk from your portfolio with 30 different stocks. You gotta be careful, make sure that they're not stocks that run together. You want stocks that kind of counter each other. They have low correlation coefficients. But that having been said, maybe 30 stocks. Now you can do that yourself, but the problem is that unless you really kind of have that as sort of like your fancy thing that you wanna do, you're going to incur transactions costs when you buy stocks and when you sell them. And so that means that you're going to be climbing out of a pit right away, waiting for stocks to gain in price, because you're going to have them gain enough in price that you pay for those commissions that you incurred to buy them. You'll also have to make sure they gain enough in price so that you can, it covers the commission you incur in selling them. That means that being one of those day traders is probably not something you want to do unless that's just you have no life and you're not particularly bright. Okay, are there ways that you can create a diversified portfolio? And I'm getting around to bonds here, trust me. Is there a way to create a diversified portfolio without buying your own stocks and keeping an eye on things like that? The answer is yes. Two different approaches you can take. One is mutual funds. Mutual funds are managed by very powerful people, extraordinarily knowledgeable, and they put together essentially a pile of securities. And then you buy a piece of the action. That action is the mutual fund. Now, they will not put together one mutual fund. They'll put together a whole bunch for different purposes, for different interests. Like, for example, you might be, I like high tech. So you could buy a mutual fund that's high tech. I like emerging markets. So you could go with that. I like green. So I'm going to have a mutual fund that goes for companies that are into energy conscious things and all that. I like international. So you might want to buy an international mutual fund. You get all the diversification. You get massive portfolio diversification. It's managed all the time, so you don't have to sweat it. And it's really cool. The downside is this. With mutual funds, you can trade in and out only a few times a year. You can't just bail whenever you want. You got a window four times a year, let's say. You could move to another mutual fund. You could shift. That's fine, but you might want to have more flexibility than that. Know this, though. Trading in stocks every day, jumping from this stock to that stock and all that, that's a fool's game. Because the best strategy over the long haul is buy and hold. The data over years, decades, centuries, buy and hold. Don't piss your pants if the markets go down. Don't all of a sudden, well, the stock markets are going up, I'm going to buy in. Well, you'll probably buy in after the stock has already gone up and all that. You should, from time to time, rebalance your portfolio. There's no question about that. You know, if one stock in your portfolio has gone up relative to the others, it would be out of balance as far as the weight in the portfolio goes. So you want to do that. But other than that, leave it alone. But that's what a mutual fund would be for anyway, is just they keep everything in balance in each of the portfolio, each of the mutual funds they manage, a fund manager group does. And then you just have to worry about longer term shifts. You shouldn't be shifting that often anyway, but you have to worry about longer term shifts. Someday you're going to be 40 years old. You're going to be fat. You're going to have high blood pressure, diabetes, and you'll be taking those little blue pills for no reason, because no woman would want you. But anyway, the thing, though, is understand that there would be probably a pivoting point where you would move your portfolio. You would want to go towards a little more defense. You have just found out that you got married. You're 25. And you're expecting your first kid. I know, right? I was just so darned excited. I just wanted to, you know, I couldn't find hemlock. It's hard to find, you know. But anyway, you're going to have to change your behaviors, change your investment patterns, plan more for the future. And so that would probably be one of those pivot points where you would want to shift your portfolio in a significant way. But as just buying and selling stocks day in and day out, that's the stupidest thing in the world to do. You're wasting money. You're wasting your time. Let the mutual fund sit there. And then as time goes on, you can move the funds, move from one fund to the other as important events in your life inform you. Or possibly as your judgment tells you the economy is flowing. So, for example, it's been good times. You have several mutual funds. One is a stock fund. One is a bond fund. Now, remember, the stock fund would be more higher risk, higher expected return. The bond fund would be a lower risk, lower expected return. You probably have, let's say you have 70% of your savings, of your investment savings in the stock fund, 30% in the bond fund. So you begin to feel the sense that there's going to be a recession coming. You would probably, in a case like that, during one of the windows when you could do it, maybe move your portfolios, maybe from 70-30 to 50-50. If you thought it was going to be a really serious recession, maybe go 40% stock mutual fund and 60% bond fund. Those would be the shift. Yes, mutual funds, there are plenty of mutual funds that are bond funds. There are stock funds, there are bond funds. There are funds that are all kinds of weird-ass animals. You can pick and choose whatever you want in a good family. Fidelity, Vanguard, you name it. Your employer will give you the opportunity to manage your own retirement, and that would probably be a management that would be choosing from mutual funds in some large family like Fidelity or Vanguard or something like that. So mutual funds are one way you can create high degree diversification, professional management of the portfolio to keep it in balance day from day to day, month to month, and all of that. The downside is that you have only four times a year or so when you can trade in the fund. Also, by the way, make sure that if you're going to do your use mutual funds for your investment vehicles, that you go with a no-load or a low-load fund. Don't go with any of those funds that require you to pay a big fee up front. There's no reason for you to do that. Plenty of excellent funds have no load. You don't pay anything up front. You just join and ride. That's one way. There is another way that you can achieve portfolio diversification that has actually much more flexibility in terms of trading than mutual funds. These are called ETFs, electronically traded funds. An ETF looks just like a stock. It has a trading symbol. It trades on a stock exchange. But an ETF is actually an index of stocks. It is a giant pile of stocks. Like, for example, you could buy an ETF that is the Standard & Poor's 500. Essentially, you own a share of that. You own one share of that ETF. You own a piece of the Standard & Poor's 500. Now, there's diversification from hell. That wasn't my car, by the way, was it? Oh, okay. I just wanted to make sure. You're all good. Anyway, that, and you buy and sell them just like stocks. You call up, you read the trading symbol, and you give, okay, I've such and such. I have, I want one round lot, such and such. You put in a limit order. I want at, let's say, 63 and a quarter or better, and all that. And it's just bought and sold like stocks. You can buy and sell them day and night, just like any stock you could. Of course, that means that you have full flexibility. Unlike a mutual fund where you can do your action only four times a year or something like that, with an ETF, it's just a stock. You can buy and sell it day and night anytime you want. You're at a party. You want to impress the hell out of your friends. I'm going to trade in my ETF. Okay, you might be the only one impressed by that, but you can do it anytime you want. Okay, so, and they're very popular, by the way. They are quite popular. I caution you, though, that there you go with that transactions cost. Every time you buy, every time you sell, you're going to pay a brokerage commission. I don't care if it's a full fee broker or one of those discount brokerage houses like Charles Schwab. You're going to pay a fee. And that is going to act as sort of like a friction on your ability to make money. Because every time you try to jump in, you're going to pay a fee. Every time you jump out to realize a capital gain, you're going to pay a fee. So just be realistic about it. It's fun when you can buy and sell and trade. And I've known many students over the years. They finally realized they wanted to be day traders. They were trading in stocks and bonds all the time. And it finally occurred to them they weren't making hardly any money because they were getting eaten up with commissions that they were paying. Anyway, so ETFs are out there. And so know that there are investment vehicles. Again, also know that buy and hold is your best bet. There were many investors when we had the crash in 2008. They just bailed out of their stocks as fast as they could. They were just running like scalded dogs for the hills. Well, of course, they would have sold after the hurricane down. And then when they started slipping back in, they slipped back in when the stock prices had already gone up a lot. The people who just sat there, the investors who just sat there, rode the donkey down and then rode it back up, they were ahead by multiples of the people who bailed and then jumped back in. Don't lose your will. Just ride. Buy and hold. Over the long haul, you will win. If you are constantly trading, every time you hear a fart, you sell. Every time you hear a laugh, you buy. You're going to lose compared to the people who just sit there and write. It's not sexy to do it that way, but that's the way to do it. Another secret, before I get down to the hardcore on bonds here one more time. Another secret, and I've already told you this one before, but I'll tell it to you again. Going with indexes. If you buy an ETF that's an index, or you buy into mutual funds or products that are composites of stocks that follow indices like the Standard Poor's 500, Wilshire 5000, Dow, those kind of things. You're called an indexer. You're following an index. It's brilliant. You're not going to do any worse than the index does. Not going to do any better, but you're not going to do any worse. And historically, the indices have done very well. Okay, we have my finance club. They want to hear these people come in and talk to them about investments. And especially one of the big things, trends right now in finance careers is financial planning, what we call the word we call wealth management now. It sounds so much sexier than financial planning. But we'll have these financial planning gurus for one of these banks in town or something like that. Well, yes, we manage people's money, and we are always online keeping an eye on stock prices and handling buys for what we think are good stocks and sells for things we don't think are good stocks. And I'll let them talk, and I'm sitting up there in the back seats where no one can really hear me, and I'm saying, bullshit! They're buying indices. They're indexers. They would be irresponsible not to be indexers. They're buying indexes, and then they're acting like they're the heroes and the geniuses saving people and making for their wealth in the future. They're just buying indices. Some of them are quasi-indexers. They'll buy and sell make a few independent buys and sells, but for the most part, they're just buying indices just like you would on your own. They're not doing anything different from what you can do yourself. That's the reality of it. That's why it is always, even the smart money rides the indices, ETFs and other instruments like those. They're not going to be fighter pilots and try to construct portfolios on their own, try to figure out hundreds of stocks to put into a portfolio, watch them every day, rebalance their portfolios for their clients every day. They're not going to do that. They're going to buy indices like everyone else does who's smart in money. Okay, enough of that. Now, down to bonds. Bonds are debt instruments. Now, I use the term bonds, and you'll hear this term, actually. You remember early in the course, I distinguished among bills, notes, and bonds. The generic term for all of these debt instruments is bonds. So, it's sort of like in economics, we use the term labor, but actually we're referring to two very different kinds. There's actual labor, and then there is human capital. We refer to equity, but there are two types of equity. There's sweat equity and investment equity. In our terminology, when I say bonds, I could be referring to instruments of different lengths. For the purposes of this lecture, I will be aiming at instruments that are generally long. They're long haulers, so they are truly bonds. Although you can do these same things with other things like short-term, a five-year debt issue, which would be an issue of notes, or something that's a very short-term, less than a year. That would be something like commercial paper. But I refer to all of it as bonds and that. Interestingly, I showed you a company called Netflix a while back, and I told you that they had raised a pile of money with debt. I noticed that in their 8K filing. If I'm not mistaken, I got to make sure I qualify this. But I'm pretty sure that they raised like $1.1 billion or some ridiculously huge amount. Debt. It was debt. They borrowed by issuing bonds and notes. So it was a combination kind of deal. Now, companies will issue based upon issue. How long will they issue? They will issue based upon their capital management strategy. The simplistic capital management strategy you might have heard before is, for short-term projects, you borrow short-term. For long-term projects, you borrow long-term. That's actually a myth. That's not how it works. But that gives you an idea. So you would have a company issue some notes and some bonds because some of the projects are short-term, some of the projects are long-term. Now, quick couple of messages about the other side of the equation. We use the term surplus economic unit for some economic agent that has money to invest. We refer to we call it a deficit economic unit if it is an agent that has money that needs money. You could actually be both a surplus unit and a deficit unit. You might have a lot of money in long-term savings, but you have no money for a cheeseburger tonight. So what are you going to do? You're going to borrow from me. You're a deficit unit short-term. You are a surplus unit long-term. Most people are actually, well, I'd love to say this, but it's not as true anymore as it used to be. Most people used to be long-term surplus economic units. In other words, they had long-term capital that they could invest, lend, or buy stocks. But they were generally tended to be short-term deficit economic units. They actually needed money for shorter-term things. So when we talk about the matching principle, we would have the surplus unit on this side. And this is, again, simplistic because you could be both at the same time. And then you have the deficit unit over here. The needer is the deficit, the provider is the surplus. Now, financial intermediation. For God's sake, write this down because I can ask you, these are the kinds of questions on the written exams that I give you, I ask you. Financial intermediation is the process of matching surplus and deficit economic units. It is the process of matching surplus and deficit economic units based upon three criteria. The amount, the timing, and the risk. So in other words, you have $1,000. I need $1,000. She knows both of us, and you're complaining to her, I'm complaining to you, I don't have $1,000, I need it. You're telling, bragging to her, I've got $1,000. So you could be a financial intermediary. You could say, all right, I'm going to put you two together. But the problem is that this one doesn't work because I'm too risky for your blood. The amount was right. The amount was right, $1,000. The amount worked. But I'm too risky for your blood. And I wanted to pay you back in a week, and you were more interested in putting something, doing an investment that would ride for a year. So one of the three worked, but two of the three did not work, so there won't be a transaction. But you, madam, you got $1,000, and you like these risky people like me. And you really wanted to, you need the money back in a week. So it would work for us because all three of the criteria are there, are met. That's financial intermediation. Now, banks and credit unions and things like that, they are traditional financial intermediaries. But don't get the impression that it is done, all it is financial institutions. There are many ways that financial intermediation can happen without any bank or anything like that being involved. interpersonally, on the internet now, financial intermediation is going on all the time on these sites like GoFundMe and that kind of stuff. So there are a lot of different ways that it can happen without financial institutions in the traditional sense being involved. But anyway, financial intermediation is the matching of surplus economic units with deficit economic units based upon amount, timing, and risk. That's all you'd have to say on the exam. If you say more than that, I'll probably take off points. Remember, on an exam, I want you to say what you have to say and then go away. Just like a CEO. He asks you a question, he doesn't want an essay. He doesn't want a dissertation. He wants a sharp answer that shows that you know what you're doing. I have a bullshit stamp, by the way. I warn you. And I just got it re-inked. You go five times around the barn until you get to the outhouse, I use it. So just say what I want you to say. Just a little hint, getting you ready for the exam in 2 weeks. Okay. Going with stocks. Stocks are long-term investments. The longest you can get. They're forever. If you are a stockholder, theoretically, you become an owner. And you are, that company has you forever. Debt is another thing. The good part about debt, aside from the fact that it's cheaper for a company than equity, the good part about debt is that eventually you get rid of it. You sell stock, you are married to the stockholder. And if that stockholder sells, you're married to someone else. It's just like that. With debt, you're done with that investor when you've paid off the debt. It's gone. It's sort of like the difference... I'm looking at you, sir. Are you going to get married someday? You dumbass. No, you're going to get married. That's your stock. That's it. It's the difference between a marriage and one night that you might regret if you remembered it. There was alcohol involved. But anyway, you see the difference is that with the long term, those people are with you forever. They're very expensive, too. Equity capital is the costliest, especially new equity. If I sell stock, that's extraordinarily expensive to the company forever. It's not just a one-time expense. That equity is a cost forever. Debt is a cost, but it's a cost only for 1 year, 30 days, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years. Now, the surplus units. We'll talk about the deficit units enough, but I want to say a few words about your surplus units here. Let me do this. And I'm doing debt right now. I'm focusing on debt. 30 days. That's a bill. It's called commercial paper. Now, there are investors who they have of money to invest for 30 days, and they need a place to invest it for 30 days. Commercial paper would be the way. You're a corporation. You need $10 million. You need it for 30 days. Well, I'm an investor. I have $10 million that I'd like to unload for 30 days. A commercial paper product would be just ideal. The clientele, it's low risk, short term, and the amounts are probably about there. Now, what kinds of investors have $10 million to kick around? $5 million, $2 million? That's easy. Many, many companies, and I've actually heard, I was listening to a fascinating conversation about this just a couple of weeks ago with a couple of friends of mine. We were having dinner, and they were talking about how they got in a check for something that they had done for $4 million. Well, the first thing was that they were laughing because they had this younger fellow who said, "Thank God, $4 million. I'm going to pay this bill, this $1 million. It's almost $1 million. I've got to pay that." And they said, "Oh, you do? It's due?" He said, "Well, actually, it's due in 30 days, but I really want to get that." And they said, "Are you out of your mind? You pay it in 30 days, you idiot. You got $1 million. We got $1 million. We can play with it for 30 days. And so they had to, the one guru at the table sat him down. He said, this is called commercial paper. Yeah, you can put that money in the, you know, we can either pay our bill with it and let him use it on that commercial paper, or we can use that $1 million ourselves and make some money off it and then pay him back in 30 days. They had $3 million more. Interestingly enough, they had more money that they would have to pay over a period of probably the next few months. And so one of the things in that department, he was saying, I had to teach this guy all these different ways that we can lend money for short periods of time and then pull it back when we need to use it for something of our own purposes. So they're making money all the time just because they've got money that they owe, but they don't have to pay it right away. This happens actually in the world of banking all the time. Are any of you familiar with what is called a sweep? You ever heard the term sweep? They used to be only for the biggest, richest companies. But over the past couple of decades, I was surprised. Back in the 80s, I ran into a guy who ran an insurance agency when I was in Dayton. And he had gotten a bank to set him up with sweeps. The way they work is, now in his insurance company, people are paying their insurance premiums, bring them into the office all the time, or back then mailing them checks in. So what he did was, on any given night, he'd have this pile of money in the bank account of the insurance agency. And he wouldn't need to use that money until the next day, you know, pay the insurance company that he was owed for the insurance premium, keep his part, or pay a light bill or something. So every night when business hours were over at 5 o'clock, the money that was in his account and all of these other accounts at that bank who were signed up for the program, that money would be swept out into the global capital markets. And there would always be this giant reservoir of money in there. Money going in at the end of closing on any given day, at any given time zone. And then the next morning, the money would be that was owed to the people in the time zone to get it back in their account. It would be pulled back out of the reservoir and go back into their account. So as the world turned on a 24-hour clock, this reservoir always had this pile of literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of capital in it. Some filling the tank, some draining the tank. And those are called sweeps. And a lot of customers that never could have done it before can participate in these sweeps. They're always there. The capital is ultra short-term available. You know, like, what, maybe 12 hours a day it's available. But still it's there, as to provide for deficit economic units around the world who need capital at any given time. That's a sweep. Very cool little things. When you get really rich, you can tell your bank, well, I'd like to get involved in sweeps. You make a little money every night. Your money doesn't just sit there. It's actually working working while you're sleeping. Anyway, that's ultra short term. And then you get all these other kinds of instruments, short-term, the commercial paper, and then a little bit longer-term kinds of things banks can use for working capital for their clients and all that kind of stuff. Then you get up to the 1 year, and then the 5, 7, 10, 20, 30. Now, every one of these different kinds of debt instruments has a clientele of investors. Now, you might be an owner of a little insurance agency, and you would be the kind of investor who would be able to provide very, very short-term capital to markets that need it. Money, actually, remember, money is referring to anything less than a year, capital more than a year. But anyway, okay. Now, let's talk about something like 30-year. Now, what kind of an investor wants to lend money for 30 years and get nothing but the coupons, the interest, every year for 30 years, and then get the investment back at the end of 30 years? What kind of an investor wants to do that? Can you think of an investor who would want to do that?
Being a big corporation.
Being more. Well, there's one thing, the ability to do that. The downside is that most corporations would want to have their actual money. Well, there's an interesting thing. There are some, and you are right as rain about that. We've got corporations that have insane money reserves. They're just sitting on, offshore. That's one of our big, big issues right now, is these massive corporations that are hiding all of their money offshore so they don't have to pay any U.S. taxes on it. And I mean, we're talking enough that if they actually brought it back and paid the taxes like they're supposed to, we would solve our deficits, literally. Google is one of the worst offenders. But another kind of company that would need money, would need a flow of money, but not much. They wouldn't need the big investment. They would go for, let's say, $100 million. They would invest $100 million in 8% corporate coupon bonds. So that would mean that every year they'd get only $8 million. It would be 30 years before they would see their $100 million back on the face value. What kind of a company would, is there any kind of company that has a cash flow need pattern like that? Can you think of anything? Okay. I'll tell you a secret. This one's, I've told you this one before. You probably didn't believe me. You're going to die. You will. Actually, you will. It's just a given. But you're not going to die today. I mean, let's say that you're 40 years old and you decide you've got to buy life insurance. You've got a wayward son. He's never going to have any money of his own. So the only way he's going to have money is when you die. And that's a problem because you do want to buy life insurance, but you don't want him to off you. But, you know, you're going to live another 30 years. So you see, life insurance companies are very, very prominent investors in bonds. Insurance companies in general, because on any given year, they're not going to have to pay a lot. That's the coupon. But they know damn well that in a longer period of time, they're going to have to pay for your funeral and for your wife's new BMW and boy toy. Okay? Do you understand? Those are the kinds of investors where the frequency is low, the severity is high. In other words, the big payouts are long term. Small payouts are shorter term. You follow the idea there? Those are the kinds of investors that like these. But then we come to, so that would explain, so we've got these like going through 6 months, one, five, seven, 10, 30, things like that, year. Investors, we can pretty much figure those out. It's not hard. You have to think about it a little bit. But what about these investors who invest in 100 to 300 year bonds? What kind of investor invests in a, what kind of an investor could possibly want to invest, let's say, $1 billion for 100 years, getting a little coupons along the way, but you aren't going to see the money for 100, 150, 200, 300 years. Okay, is there an investor that could possibly want to do that? There are. What kind are they? Anyone know? Take a guess? Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing. Governments, if they had the money, they'd invest, but they don't usually have the money. God knows ours don't. That's a very good, that's a good stab if governments that were actually fiscally responsible. Anything else? Any of you in here ever hear of something called New Madrid? M-A-D-R-I-D? We're actually sitting very close to it. New Madrid is a fault line running from Indiana down through into the southern part of the state, cross down into Missouri. The New Madrid fault, which is a very unusual fault, not like many faults anywhere else in the world, The last time it gave was in the early 1800s. I had a wonderful opportunity to read letters that people in St. Louis wrote in the time after it. It was like reading modern apocalyptic fiction. Smoke and debris, cities gone, wandering, burned people everywhere. The earthquake, when the New Madrid fault line slipped, the earthquake was so powerful that it threw the water of the Mississippi River back north. And then the river came back south like a it was a tidal wave, and it obliterated everything that had not already been obliterated by the earthquake. But there wasn't one earthquake. There was a series of aftershocks, and then another major earthquake about a month later. It was unbelievable, the destruction. Among earthquakes in recorded history, it ranks very high. And it's right here. Right with us. And it's getting more unstable. You see, this is one that, it's not going to quake every year, not even every 50 years, not even every 100 years, maybe every couple hundred. That's where a property and casualty insurance company that was involved in major coverage of major disasters would put its investments. They won't need that money probabilistically for decades, if not centuries. But when they need it, they'll need a lot of it. So investing in extremely long-term debt instruments is a great thing for them because they can put it someplace where they know they'll have a certain cash flow year over year, but they won't have to worry about the pile of money coming back to them at any time when they probably wouldn't need it. Hence, you would insure a building against an attack by a giant airliner. Now, how often does a giant airliner attack a skyscraper? Hardly ever. But it did. And so you would have an insurance company that insures against catastrophic terrorist attacks against skyscrapers that would want to put its investments in very long-term instruments because it's very unlikely that they would need it in any given year, decade, or possibly even century. There you go. Interesting story about the World Trade Center. Now, this is rumor. But the World Trade Center, are you old enough to remember there was two buildings standing like this? One of them was insured. You see, because the probability that one of them would ever fall down was ridiculously low, the probability that two of them at the same time would go down, no way. Oops, they both did. And WTC 7 went down with them. So that was a rather bad insuring decision. But there you go. Okay, those are the different kinds of surplus units. There is a clientele for every kind of risk, amount, and timing level. You look like the kind of guy who goes to payday loans. Yep. Uh-huh. And so you're the kind of guy. That's the risk level, the amounts, and the timing. You want it now before you die because of that bookie that you put that bet with. Why did you ever even bother to bet on the Cubs? You know, seriously. Anyway, so there's something for you even out there. There is someone for everyone. You just have to find it. The markets are that complete. Now, bonds. Did I just have a small stroke? It's black. I have got to start taking that baby aspirin every morning. Oh, there it is. It lit back up. I thought I was having an artery clog or something. Okay, now. Getting down to the basics of bonds, you're going to need information to be able to price them. Now, the traditional, and I wish the hell they gave these bond quotes. And there used to be places where you get all these different, you know, bonds, high-grade bonds, low-grade bonds, junk bonds, the big gainers, the big losers on a given day, and all that kind of stuff. Now, you're going to get a trading symbol. Let's say AXB. You're going to get a coupon 6.45%. And you're going to get a year when it matures. Now, this probably is not a new issue. This is, I would tell you right now, I know this would not be a new issue bond. Do you see why this would not be a new issue bond? I don't know. I'm kind of pushing you a little farther than you probably want to be right now. Do you see why this is not a new issue bond? Okay. What's the year when it matures? 2028. Now, how many years is that from right now? That's because you did that better than I did. Whatever. Okay, yeah, 12. That would be an unusual for a company to issue, have just issued 12-year bonds. Okay, this probably was, I would speculate, well, this might have been issued in 2008. There, it would be a 20, in other words, it's a 20-year bond that's still 12 years out. Or it might be 1998, it's a 30-year bond. It's just, it probably wouldn't be a new issue 12-year bond. You would see something like 20-year, 30-year out, 10-year out for a new issue. So this is a bond that's out there. In other words, this is a bond that's trading in the secondary market, investors buying it, investors selling it, and all of that kind of stuff. Now, you will have one of two, okay, so this would be the year of maturity. When it pays its last coupon and then pays and also pays its face value off. This would be the coupon which is always based upon, always based upon the face value. And the face value is always, I love it when you talk like that. It's just like Denny's for us tonight. Let's get 2 grand slams. Okay. Yeah. And orange juice. You need orange juice. You're looking a little peaked. Okay. This always goes into the calculator as a dollar amount. This always, you would put in 64.50 in your calculator. Don't ever confuse this with that I over Y. That's the yield to maturity, the discount rate that the market is assessing. So if it's the thing, and I'm making a big fuss about this because I've seen over the years, the place where people usually make the mistake in doing the bond problems is they put the coupon rate, they see a percent, and they put that in as the I over Y. It's not, okay? Now, in the next class, I will explain. This is $64.50. And this is 12 years. In other words, the company is going to pay $64.50 every year for 12 more years. And then it's going to pay the face value. It's not going to be stated to you, but the face value is $1,000. That will not be told to you, but you know that's what it is. It's that. And then you're going to have your yield to maturity. That will be, and if I do this, let me do something here real quick for you. I'm going to put up the calculator here just for a minute and just do something real quick. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Go, 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 go. Okay, this is section 4. Okay. I'm going to get the yield on this one right now, real quick here. $64.50 is the payment, enter, and that is one period per year, and N should be 12. One period per year. I don't know if I hit the enter button or not. The face value is 1,000. And so I can compute. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. No, I don't want to do that. Compute that off. Let me put out in the present value. Let's say that I put in the present value. This bond is selling at a slight discount to par. $990.25. Negative present value, enter, compute the yield. Wait, I put in 99.25, and that's the payment. Oh, jeez. Walk and chew gum at the same time. Let me do this. 12. N. Enter. One period per year. Enter. Present value, let's say $990.20, 25 cents. That's always going to be put in as a negative. PV. Enter. And then the payments are $64.50 per year. Enter, and the future value is, wait, let's do that again. Clear. $64.50 is the payment, enter, and $1,000 is the future value, enter. Compute the yield to maturity, 6.57%. And the price was $990.25. You will be given one of these two. You will either be given the yield or you will be given the price. You will not be given both. If you're given the price, you find the yield, which is what I just did there. If you're given the yield, you find the price. You will be given one of them. And you find the other of those two. As you can see, the price of this bond was selling at a discount to par. It was selling below 1,000. Why was it selling below 1,000? Because the market said this bond should pay 6.57% coupon, but it pays only 6.45% coupon. So the market paddles this bond. Investors get out of it and drop the price until it's worth being an investment. You follow me on that? Now, there's one in the real world. This is sort of like the abstraction. In the real world, bonds actually pay the coupon twice a year. They cut the annual coupon into two pieces, which means that the number of periods is two times the number of years. If the coupons are being paid twice as often, in other words, you take each coupon and divide it by two, that means that the number of periods is going to be twice as many. Let me show you what the practical effect of that is for a realistic bond calculation. It's really, there's only one part of it that can really catch you. Watch out for the one part. I'm going to go back through and I'm going to say, well, this was a 12-year bond, so that means that there would be 24 payments. And because the annual coupon was $64.50, that means every 6 months they would get a $32.25 payment. Now, the problem with doing this is that if you do it this way, you get actually only half of the right yield. You have to times this by 2 to get the actual yield. That's where, I swear, almost everyone gets confused about that, because you've divided the coupon into 2 to double the number of periods, so the calculator will report back only half of the right answer for the yield. There's a way around this. And we're going to do this again. Don't sweat it. If you're not catching this right now, I'm going to do it again for you on Thursday, okay? Or on Wednesday. But there's a way around this. Let me reset and do it from scratch. I'm not actually sure. The number of years, let me do it, was 12. The price was $990.25. Oops, I got to put that in. The payments were $64.50. The present value, or rather the face value, future value, was $1,000. Did I do that right? Yeah, okay. Let me do that again, 12. I don't remember if I hit the enter button, enter. But now, if I say 2 payments per year, crap, didn't work. Oh well. Let me try something. Oops, let me try something here. There's a trick I was shown, that you 24 and enter. Well, my ass. I thought I could do that, but this calculator can't quite pull that trick off. So anyway, do it this way. Now I'm going to give you, let's do another one, just to give you one more example. God, I'm hot in here. Okay, let's do CLA 5.50%. 2034, and it is currently trading at $1,030.55. Okay. Now notice that this bond is selling at a premium to par. So we're going to find, we got the price, so we need to find the yield. No doubt about it, that yield should be lower than that coupon, because apparently investors like this bond. You see how the investors are paying more than par for it? So that would mean that this bond must be selling at a premium. This bond's yield must be less than what the coupon is. So we're going to just crank it through, do it straight up. Okay, now, and we're going to do it with the realistic, 2 payments a year and all that kind of stuff. So what that means is that 2034, that would be 18 years from now, right? For God's sake. Okay, I so suck at arithmetic. Okay, that's 18 years from now, but that would mean that there would be 18 times 2 payments. So I'll put that 36 in as N, enter. Well, that sucked. 36, N, enter. Okay, now, the price value is $1,030.50. 5.5. Don't forget, if you're putting a present value, make it a negative. Don't ask me why. It's been that way with computers since forever. That will be the present value, and we enter that. The payments, 5.5, that's $55 a year. So each of the checks that grandma gets on her investment, she's getting them every 6 months, so it would be half of that. $27.50. So that's what we put in for the payment and enter it. And then the $1,000, don't ever forget to put in your $1,000 face value, enter. Now, this way, just put in a 1 for the P over Y. I wish I knew how that P over Y worked. I've never figured that one out. But anyway, now, compute the yield to maturity. That's not the answer, for God's sake. Don't let that trick you. That's half of the answer. The actual answer is 2.62 times 2. Darn it, I thought I could 2.62. I thought I could do that. It didn't work. 2.62 times 2. 5.24%. I'm almost sure I got the answer right. Why am I pretty sure I got this answer right? Do you see when I got that number? Yeah. Bingo. Absolutely. It's not horribly lower. I mean, if it were way down there, if I wrote down 2.62, I'd know. That's ridiculous. I mean, but it's just slightly lower. That tells me absolutely I've got, well, not absolutely. I mean, I could have farted and made a mistake, but I'm pretty sure that's the right answer, okay? That's one of the nice things about these problems. It's almost like you can tell if you've done something wacky. It's so far off. The fancy term in math is it is parameter sensitive. If I put something in wrong, whatever I put in wrong, it'll just go cuckoo bananas. The formula will. So this I am pretty darn sure this is below this, which means that it should be selling at a premium to par because the market says it doesn't need to pay as much as it is. Well, spank me, Jesus, it is. It's selling at a premium to par. That's what's really nice about these bond problems is it's almost like everything is on the calculator. These used to, by the way, when we did them by hand, these were a pain in the ass. Now with this calculator, it's almost a joke. That's all I have for you. Go home.